this idea that we should reduce our animal products for any number of reasons is grossly irresponsible.
On this week's podcast, I had the pleasure of talking to my friend, Dr. Gabrielle Lyon. She has a new book out called Forever Strong, where she talks about the importance of muscle for longevity. There are so many conversations around longevity now. It's just in vogue to talk about. And I just don't think that the key to longevity is nutty pudding, caloric restriction, and 100 pills a day, or a million different technological biohacks. I think it's good quality nutrition, maintaining muscle mass. And so enjoy this conversation with Gabrielle Lyon. She has a very unique perspective on this. She still sees patients, which I appreciate. Her clinical expertise is incredible. And she is in the trenches working with people and has seen so many people improve by increasing their consumption of, you guessed it, plant protein. No, not plant protein, animal protein and organs. And we talk about all kinds of cool stuff in this podcast. So check her out, check her new book, Forever Strong, out, and enjoy the value that I think is in this podcast. Dr. Gabrielle Lyon, thank you for coming on the podcast. It's great to have you. Congratulations on the release of your new book.
Thank you, my friend. Thanks so much for having me. It's been a long time coming.
I know, it's been too long. We haven't hung out in person. So I have a question for you to start. Tell me why muscle is the organ of longevity, because if I go to YouTube and I listen to longevity experts, I'm going to conclude that nutty pudding, green smoothies, and caloric restriction with over 100 pills a day is how I achieve longevity. So I appreciate your divergent perspective.
Well, first of all, that sounds like an exhaustive plan. That many supplements and that kind of food just, number one, sounds exhaustive. And number two, just doesn't sound pleasurable to eat. Skeletal muscle is the organ of longevity. And I think that that is becoming much more mainstream in the concept that skeletal muscle is an endocrine organ. Above and beyond being fit, it truly is our metabolic sink. It is our body armor. It interfaces with the immune system. It's an endocrine organ. You name it, skeletal muscle interfaces with the result of many of the metabolic diseases that we're, quote, facing now, like diabetes, obesity, you name it, metabolic syndrome. You know, oftentimes the individuals are talking about it as if it's something out there. It's obesity is the cause. Obesity is just a result. Obviously, it is complex in the cause, and there can be many things that are going on, and same with insulin resistance. But at the end of the day, there's only one organ that we can do anything about, and that's skeletal muscle. And the data also supports that the more healthy skeletal muscle mass you have, the greater your survivability against disease. It's not if, it's when something is going to happen.
I never really thought about it that way, but it's a good point. I guess if I do some amount of cardiovascular activity, I can sort of improve my heart, but muscle, you can really affect this organ with what you do in your life. By doing resistance training, by doing the things in our lives, we massively, or even nutrition, which we'll talk about, both of those things. It's not like I can really do that with my liver, although I think there are things we could do to support our livers, but it's not like I can increase the size of my brain necessarily by, I guess maybe in some ways there are parallels, but muscle is like very visible. You know, you do these things and you can change the amount of muscle and how well it functions. That's really interesting.
And not only that, you have cognitive control over it. It's something that skeletal muscle, you have voluntary control over. You cannot think of your liver and make it bigger. I mean, maybe you could exercise it by drinking, but the reality is you couldn't think your heart or your brain bigger. But skeletal muscle, when you create a plan and really focus as it relates to longevity, you have an exponential goldmine of something that you can improve upon. And again, when we talk about health outcomes, you have to be able to execute off of something that is going to create an outcome. And the outcome is clear with skeletal muscle. The outcome is clear, and it's something that you can absolutely gain tissue no matter what your age. You can gain both strength and actual skeletal muscle tissue no matter how old you are.
And there's something really cool that you point out in your book, which is this idea of myokines. I don't think many people know about myokines. Let's talk about these a little bit. Idea that you flex the muscle and it releases essentially signaling molecules into the body. That's wild.
Yeah. So myokines, the science behind myokines is relatively new. I would say it's been for the last 23 years. There's hundreds of different myokines. I think that they've categorized around 60. The most famous is interleukin-6, and interleukin-6, which we are very familiar with when it is released from macrophages in what we would consider a cytokine storm, the skeletal muscle releases interleukin 6 depending on the duration and intensity of training. And it releases myokines, but the interleukin 6 has a different effect on the body, a different effect than the myokines that are released from macrophages. It dampens the immune system. It creates somewhat of an anti-inflammatory counterbalancing impact, which is incredible to think that one of the reasons why a sedentary lifestyle may be so dangerous is not just the health of skeletal muscle, because it's that decreased glycogen flux that can create a lot of reactive oxygen species and intramyocellular lipids. You have to train the tissue to generate that flux. But the other underappreciated aspect of skeletal muscle is that contracting component, that contractile component that releases these myokines. When you do not release these myokines, then you do not impact the immune system in the same way. It also has an effect on lipolysis. It also has an effect on glucose regulation, not just the contracting skeletal muscle utilizing energy and ATP, mitochondria, but again, just the actual homeostatic mechanism. And that's just one myokine. There's also BDNF, which we've heard of, capsaicin B. There's just a whole host. There's a myokine that can affect tumor regulation, decorin.
All kinds of things released from the muscle. Is it known? I suppose it might be a different threshold for different myokines, but when I don't move enough, if I'm traveling and I'm sitting on a plane, I recently went to Australia. It's a 15-hour flight, right? And so I have to get up every few hours and do squats, and the people on the plane just think I'm hilarious. But they haven't called the
TSA on you.
I've got some pretty funny TSA stories that I'll have to tell you offline, but they haven't, but it's like, I can just feel that my brain is not as healthy and my outlook on the world is not as good, presumably related to BDNF or other neurologic mediators, when I don't move enough. And it's rare that I don't move enough, but sometimes I don't. Like recently, so I went to Australia. This is crazy. I went to Australia. I got food poisoning on the plane. And I land in Australia after 15 hours on a plane, which is not a good place to get food poisoning. And then for the next four days, I have bad food poisoning. And I am just not moving because I have food poisoning and I don't want to move. And so it was just, for me, like a breath of fresh air that after 4 days of not moving, I could actually finally do some sort of activity, whether it was getting in the water and surfing or doing a hike and walking uphill for 5 to 10 minutes. It just felt so refreshing for my brain. And I imagine that was related to just this dearth of myokines, because I just wasn't moving because I was so sick. So is it known how much we need to move to get these myokines to be stimulated? Somebody sitting in an office, you know, can they do 5 flights of stairs or 10? Like, what's the minimum effective dose? Do we even know?
This is a phenomenal question. And Pedersen out of Copenhagen is really paving the way for this. When I was researching for my book, Forever Strong, we hesitated to put any kind of minimum recommendation because I just don't think that we know enough about it yet. What we can do is that we can focus on muscle health. If you target muscle health, then the subsequent release of the myokines, one could conclude, would be adequate. And it doesn't take much to maintain skeletal muscle health. I mean, some of the earlier studies that I worked on out of Lehman's lab, they were doing 30 minutes of walking 5 days a week and 2 days a week of some kind of yoga as resistance training. And that was very minimal. And that was enough to maintain lean body composition. My guess is that will probably be the minimum effective dose. And again, there's a whole body of literature looking at the different myokines, but we're not in a place yet where we can measure them because it's just so volatile. Interleukin 6 is very, could you measure it? You can absolutely measure it, but it is volatile.
That's very helpful though. 30 minutes of walking a day, 2 days of maybe some resistance training, because I traveled way more this past year than I wanted to, but I thought, you know, like I can do push-ups anywhere. I can do body weight squats anywhere. I travel with an exercise band. I can do shoulder stretches with body weight squats, and I can walk 30 minutes anywhere I go, and I can jump, you know, I can go outside and just jump onto a bench or something. So I think that's really good to know that like this doesn't have to be an hour to 2 hours in a gym lifting weights every day for any human. It just is minimal, but not zero, intentional movement to achieve muscle maintenance and muscle health, which results in all of these endocrine compounds that are secreted and better brain health. And then you also said better immune system function. I wish I had found her package sooner. Check out this review on her package from Heart and Soil Supplements. I know it's a lot of you guys listening to this podcast, but I know you guys have ladies in your life. Or ladies, this one is for you. This is the review. After being on hormonal birth control for most of my adolescence, I was left with my hormones all out of whack, even 5 years after I stopped taking birth control. While my cycle has always been very consistent, my mood swings, brain fog, fatigue leading up to my period always left me feeling like a zombie. No one tells you about the aftermath of putting synthetic hormones in your body for years and years. I suffered for so long with unstable mood, fatigue, migraines, awful cramping, the whole shebang. When I found her package from Heart and Soil Supplements and read the reviews and testimonies, I swear I have never put something in my cart so dang fast. Over 4 months in, I can tell you that this stuff works in caps. The first cycle after starting her package, I was actually taken by surprise when my period came because I didn't experience the same crazy mood swings, crankiness, anxiety, brain fog, etc. leading up to it. I actually cried tears of joy because I finally felt like something was helping after years of trying different diets and supplements with no improvement. All I can say is that I wish I had found her package sooner. So her package is our supplement at Heart and Soil aimed at ladies. But again, you dudes out there with ladies in your life, let them know about this. It's desiccated organs and it contains ovaries, uterus, fallopian tubes, along with liver and kidney. And look at the reviews. They're amazing. I think that for women, changing the quality of their diet is critical, but getting desiccated organs support the corresponding organs. So if you know someone or you are a woman with any issues hormonally, check out her package from Heart and Soil Supplements. You can find us at heartandsoil.co. That's .co. Our mission is to help you reclaim your birthright to radical optimal health. All of our supplements are always in glass. No bullshit here, no plastic. They're all grass-fed, grass-finished, regeneratively raised, all from New Zealand and Australia. Those are the finest sources of organs on the planet. Do not accept imitators because those are often from Chile and Argentina, and the cows in Chile and Argentina are not raised the same way they are in New Zealand and Australia. If you've ever been to New Zealand or Australia, and I just went to New Zealand and Australia and saw the regenerative farms there, actually the farms where we source some of our organs from for Heart and Soil, it is fields of green grass, healthy cows, views of the ocean. It is incredible. The problem with a lot of Chilean and Argentinian cattle operations is that they are CAFO. They are clustered feeding operations, and they're not nearly the quality you're going to get from New Zealand and Australia. So we're very proud to feature New Zealand organs in our supplements. And I believe that supporting this regenerative agriculture is the way to do it. Again, find us at heartandsoil.co. Back to the podcast.
Yeah, I want to frame the narrative. Let's think about skeletal muscle as an organ system. It makes up 40% of the body weight. Imagine if that becomes pathological. If that tissue has pathology, just by sheer mass, the impact it's going to have. Conversely, if we keep it healthy, then imagine the long-term effects as it relates to aging and overall health and wellness. Contracting skeletal muscle releases glutamine. This was really some of the earlier research that connected the immune system and exercise. Contracting skeletal muscle releasing glutamine, which is a semi-essential amino acid, is an energy source for lymphocytes, cells of the immune system. Incredible. There are incredible ways to leverage skeletal muscle and reframing the narrative away from being jacked and tan to truly, I mean, you know, jacked and tan, having good hair, to truly shifting the conversation from a medical perspective.
Yeah. And I think that that's so important. I think of my 73-year-old mother and father, and it's like, my mom walks if she can. My dad just doesn't move enough. Mm-hmm. And they're not doing any resistance training. And you just think for people of that age, but also for people who are younger in office jobs, like some degree of attention to keeping the muscle healthy through movement is critical. Now, at what point does it become too much? Or let's just start, we started with the bottom level, right? Or the beginning level, which is adequate. A little bit of walking, some resistance training, maybe do push-ups or sit-ups or the basic things that we can do, pull-ups, if you can do a pull-up. What's the next level? Like, is there a benefit to going beyond that? Is there a benefit to resistance training a few times a week above and beyond the maintenance of the muscle?
Certainly. One has to understand that maintenance will only get you so far. It becomes more difficult to build muscle as you age, depending on how you live your life. And the reason that is because hormones decline. If an individual is not on hormone replacement, there is just a natural decline. It's also thought that skeletal muscle, which is a nutrient sensing organ, becomes increasingly insulin resistant. And I know I've listened to many of your podcasts, and your audience is very astute. The question is that true, that skeletal muscle, because of age, becomes insulin resistant, or is it really due to lack of activity? It is probably more due to lack of activity. That being said, understanding that it does become easier to build muscle earlier on, and there's things that change. For example, capillary perfusion and splenic extraction for nutrients, for amino acids. Your original question is, how much is the minimum and how much would be the maximum? This is highly dependent. One way to think about it is thinking about what is the ultimate goal. Should people do cardiovascular activity? When I break it down, I think about, as nerdy as this might be, somewhat of the fiber types. I might think of slow twitch and fast twitch muscles, just again, because I'm a geriatrician by training and I had to do those early morning biopsies, which I feel bad for myself still many years later. And slow twitch type 1 fibers, you think about endurance activity. You think about high mitochondrial density, all of which is important. We've seen that over time, if you are inactive, one of the hallmarks of aging is a decrease in mitochondrial function. Therefore, doing some kind of stimulation of zone 2 training can potentially be beneficial. This tissue seems to be much easier to maintain as we age versus the fast twitch type fibers or type 2 fibers. These are the low mitochondrial density fibers. They have more glycogen, and this is where glucose goes. This is the main place for glucose disposal, which really is skeletal muscle. These fibers seem to be more challenged. And oftentimes we see an individual who's aging, like your parents. They probably were buffer when they were younger. And that may be because they didn't keep up with their training, or again, were they active enough? Did they have enough dietary protein? All questionable, but it seems that making sure the minimum effective dose in my mind for muscle maintenance is about 10 sets per muscle group per week, if you wanted to really make it basic. But I think it's important to understand there's two targets that we're looking at. We're looking at type 1 fibers, type 2 fibers, endurance, and then fast twitch. In addition, fast twitch, you would train with resistance type exercise. And I'm saying this in blanketed terms. Oftentimes, there's this continuum where we think about strength, hypertrophy, and endurance. Each training modality seems to have a different metabolic stimulus. Could you get the same benefit? Could your 71-year-old mom get the same muscle hypertrophy benefit if she was lifting lighter weights, more reps? The data would suggest yes. The question becomes, what about the molecular signaling? So it is different. There's a potential that the molecular signaling is different from heavier weights versus lighter weights. There's a lot of things to consider, especially when we're thinking about functionality. So to round out the question, 10 sets per exercise, it could be high weight, it could be lower weight. But probably if it were my parent, my dad who lives in Ecuador, I suggest that he lifts heavier and also adds in rotation, because we're not training to be in the gym. We're not training to become better at exercise. We're training to become more effective and efficient at life and have more capacity and to be as healthy and as sturdy and as resilient as we can. And that involves doing actual movements, like doing a farmer's carry, like doing things that are meaningful, like being able to squat down, do a deadlift, pick something up, put it overhead.
Now, this is an interesting thing that I was thinking about as I was reading your book and thinking about this podcast. Is there any evidence for patterning or memory in the muscles? Neither of my parents is particularly muscular. And I started lifting weights in high school. I hit puberty really late, and I think I was sort of insecure, and I was never very athletic until the end of high school. I started lifting weights. And then in college, I lifted weights a lot. It sort of became my thing. And then I started running. But in my early adulthood years, I had a lot of weightlifting training in the gym. It was very basic stuff. I don't even know if I was squatting. I was probably mostly just doing upper body because I was in college and I wanted to look good for girls. But one thing that I've noticed is that it's pretty easy for me to maintain muscle now. And currently, I don't do a whole lot of lifting. I surf every day and I skate every day, skateboard on a ramp at my house.
Which is pretty cool.
Yeah, it is pretty cool. It is pretty cool. And I'll do bodyweight squats in the morning. I'll do some of like Ben Patrick's knees over toes stuff. I'll do some single leg. I love single leg pistol squats. And I'll do pull-ups throughout the week, but I don't do much beyond that. I'm not really even picking up a barbell most weeks. And my muscle mass stays pretty constant. Now, to be fair, I'm rambling, but if I go to the United States and I can't skate and I can't surf and I go to a gym every day, I can lift weights and my body composition may change a little bit. But even with like surfing and skating and bodyweight stuff, I maintain a pretty decent amount of muscle mass. I'm like 5'9 and 165, 170 pounds. So I'm fairly muscular. Now, I've always wondered, is that just because, is there any evidence that that had to do or might have contributed to like my early onset of weightlifting? And I want people to think about this because then the corollary question is, when can kids start? Like when should parents make it fun? Like do some push-ups with me, do some pull-ups. When is it okay for kids to start? And could we be setting up kids or young adults for better success in life if we give them a memory of the muscles, if it's possible?
It's absolutely possible. And you did what I would suggest anybody doing. You say that you started later, but you started at a time where you still had a ton of potential and you were still growing. And that is why you're able to maintain the physique that you have. And you're still very active to this day and continue to be active. When I wrote my book, that was the most surprising aspect of the book. And I have a section on children. The common thinking is that children shouldn't train and that children should not train with weights. There's actually no evidence to support that. And in fact, the guideline recommendation is to include some kind of resistance training. And it can be at any age. My 2.5-year-old lifts little weights. And again, Leonidas is not doing a 1 rep max deadlift, but we are so concerned about all this other stuff, childhood obesity and being in front of the iPad, you know, but it seems as if the overarching conversation that mirrors that is this idea of, well, don't start too early exercising. Those kids should not start early training. And that actually is totally untrue. And in fact, it's recommended that they do have structured activity as early as possible.
One of the things, I think that one of the coolest things that I have a sister and she has 2 kids and they are, I guess the younger is going to turn 4, maybe tomorrow. And the older...
You better know that, just so you know.
I know.
You better be sending presents. You're in major trouble.
the younger one turns 4 tomorrow and the older one turns 6 in January. And for Christmas, a couple of years ago, I got them like an indoor gym. And it's so cool to see them use this. And I just love to see the kids. They love it. And it's just, you know, my sister has a room in her house. It's kind of just a playroom. And so they have a soft floor and they have cushions that come with this gym. But it's just monkey bars and a few ropes and they swing on it and they climb this little net. And I just think like, that's so cool that they're using body weight to move. And I really hope that it's going to help them. But I think that they're doing weightlifting without knowing it because kids just want to play. I guess it's the beauty of playgrounds. The cool thing about the indoor playground is they can use it all year round and they live in Virginia. So it's not always hospitable conditions, but it's really cool to think that you can help set your children up for success by encouraging them to do some sort of resistance training as early in life as they're interested in doing it. If they see you doing it, they can do it with you. And for me, it's a very interesting thing that I wonder about. Like, I don't think anybody pushed me to do it. I just wanted to look better. And so I went to this local gym, Oakmar Recreation Center in Northern Virginia, and I mostly used machines and I just lifted weights. And then in college, I started doing weightlifting and I didn't do it the whole time, but I believe it probably set me up for some success by giving my muscles that memory of like, hey, this is what you're going to do. And then so later in life, if people didn't do that, so there's probably a lot of people listening to the podcast, and I think my audience is mostly male, but I know there's some ladies out there. Later in life, if you didn't lift weights in your teenage years, can we also pattern muscle and give the muscle some sort of memory? Because ultimately, like we're talking about, what we want is to have a healthy amount of skeletal muscle. And that's a relative term, but most people are probably under muscled. That's to borrow your term. And so do you think that for most people, especially if they're under muscled, like this resistance training is really a requirement. You need to really give your muscles that signal. And that can improve, like we said, immune system, brain function, and also metabolism, which helps people lose weight.
It's a non-negotiable. And I was looking at some of the data, and these are 89-year-old individuals able to still gain strength and mass.
Wow.
Which is incredible. That is how plastic this tissue is. One of the other things that happens if you are sedentary is the tissue that you want your skeletal muscle to be like is a fillet. And over time, again, I'm a geriatrician by training. And when you look at images, whether it's CT or MRI, you can see fat infiltrate into the tissue over time. That, depending on where you are in that continuum, can be changed. You can reverse it. There are things that you can do. And again, it's never too late. You do need to do some resistance training. Will cardiovascular activity help in some regard? It will, but really, it's not just about the health of the mitochondria. It really is about hypertrophy and strength. Both of those things become critical. And the more muscle you have, the more healthy muscle you have, the more mitochondria that you have.
And you mentioned something earlier. I guess we can transition. So we've talked about movement a little bit. I want to talk about nutrition for muscle. There is this, when I was in medical school, there was this sort of, I don't know if it was the same when you were in medical school, but this sort of subtle brainwashing.
Subtle. No, it's still happening.
That
it's
humans,
still happening.
It probably is that humans just become decrepit. And it's not our fault that our blood pressure rises as we age. That we become more insulin resistant as we age. And we mentioned this earlier, that perhaps that insulin resistance is due to less movement. But I also I really believe strongly that all of these things are due to dietary accumulation of garbage as we age. And this is, I think people will look at professional athletes and say, how can diet be important for muscle health or health of humans when the best athletes on the planet eat McDonald's and chicken nuggets? And my answer is, well, give them 10 years and see what they look like, because it accumulates. And I think that there is a tipping point for most of us. And the takeaway that I get from this is, hey, look, seed oils are not benign. And the accumulation of excess linoleic acid in the mitochondrial membranes of muscles or any tissue in the body probably also contributes to worsening insulin resistance as we age. And it's wild to me that Western medicine doesn't have this awareness, and that it's just this kind of, I don't know, this kind of... just this default, like, hey, your patients are going to get more obese, they're going to get weaker, they're going to get more chronically ill as they age, and good for you, we have these wonderful medications for you to give them. And there's no discussion of like how we avoid that. So how do you think someone can best support their muscles nutritionally? Like, what do we need to put in our bodies to support this organ?
Well, I want to frame this. I don't know if I've ever told you this story. Did I ever tell you about some of the research that I did when I was at WashU?
No.
Where these concepts came from? I'm going to frame it for you because it actually piggybacks lovely off of what you're saying. I did 2 years of geriatric training, and I actually didn't want to do it. The deal was, I mean, no surprise, right? End of life, very depressing, working in the hospital. You know it, right? You did it for a period of time. Before you did psychiatry, you did cardiology, and it is not a beautiful place to be. It is heart-wrenching. I wanted to go back. So I did an undergraduate in nutritional sciences, and then I wanted to go back and do a fellowship in nutrition. In order to do a fellowship in nutritional sciences and not just have it be medical, I had to get funding. The way that I was going to get funding was I agreed to be a geriatric fellow. So I had a dual role as a geriatric fellow, which is an individual who takes care of individuals over the age of 65. My role transitioned through nursing homes on the weekend, dementia clinics, palliative care, which is end of life, and so on. Very stroke ward, just all of it. Very, very, very depressing. In the evenings and the early mornings, I did obesity medicine research. And one of the studies that we were working on at the time was looking at body composition and brain volume. This one participant, we'll just call her Betty, she is the picture of the majority of 50-some-year-old women that we see today. She was a mom of three. She had cycled through years of losing the same 10 to 20 pounds. The medical community had given the advice to eat less, exercise more, do Weight Watchers, continue to restrict your calories. When we imaged her brain looked like the beginning of an Alzheimer's brain. And it was at that moment I felt, you know how it is. There's always a one patient that you really connect with and you just love and you don't want to see anything. I mean, you feel that way about all your patients, but there was this just, she pulled at a heartstring and we failed her. We failed her. The medical community had failed her. She had done everything that she was told to do. She ate less, she exercised more, and in the process, over and over, year after year, she totally destroyed her skeletal muscle. Her body fat was easily 35% with very little skeletal muscle. She had issues with blood sugar regulation, insulin, triglycerides, all of the things that you would imagine were to happen. The thing is no one had given her any advice to improve her skeletal muscle, which is at the core of these issues. Skeletal muscle is just the focal point, to do resistance training and to improve the quality and nutrient density of her food with high quality proteins. And I feel that we just totally destroyed her life. And then I started to think, what is the one thing that all these sick patients have in common? And quite frankly, it wasn't obesity. It wasn't that they were overfat. These patients with dementia and these patients with other disease processes, what they had was they didn't have enough skeletal muscle. They had unhealthy skeletal muscle. And that's where muscle-centric medicine came from. I just wanted to share that because it really does piggyback to what you're saying is, number one, framing why is skeletal muscle so important, and we've completely missed the boat. And in fact, we don't even measure it directly, by the way. When you get a DEXA, DEXA is body fat percentage. You're laughing because you know exactly what I'm talking about. And you can recognize that we've built a foundation of information and knowledge on the shoulders of things that are surrogate markers. And when you do that, inevitably, there is going to be a shift, a change in paradigm when we begin to directly measure this tissue, which is actually what is going to happen through something called a D3 creatine. It's a deuterated creatine. It's tagged creatine. We're going to take a pill and you're going to be able to see how much muscle mass you have. It's going to be a urinary test. You're going to be able to see how much muscle mass. And for the astute listener, you're going to think, we were talking about muscle mass and strength. The literature, the large body of literature would suggest that mass doesn't matter, which doesn't make any cognitive sense. The idea that skeletal mass doesn't matter, that it's all strength, that really it's about strength. And my argument would be, well, we haven't been measuring it directly. And what we're starting to see is as soon as we begin measuring skeletal muscle directly, then yes, there is a relationship between skeletal muscle mass and strength. And actually, the loss of skeletal muscle is more impactful than the gain of body fat as we age.
And that's something that can't be emphasized enough. That's essentially sarcopenia, right?
Yeah, it is sarcopenia. Yes.
Which is a term, in case people are not familiar, help us understand what sarcopenia is.
Are you ready for this? Are you ready to have your mind blown? Well, maybe everyone else maybe have their mind blown. The International Classification for Disease, which if you're a physician listening to this, you know that this is the ICD-10 code. Sarcopenia is the loss of skeletal muscle mass and function. It's believed to be about 1% per decade after 50 years. I believe that it is higher, and I believe that it starts much earlier. I believe it starts in your 30s if you are inactive, just like heart disease and Alzheimer's. The ICD-10 code for sarcopenia to recognize it as a disease was 2016. Tell me that isn't mind-blowing.
It didn't exist before the last few years.
It wasn't recognized as a disease. And I want to highlight something else, that if you look at the causes of mortality. So the number of deaths for, according to the CDC, you have the top causes of death, heart disease, cancer, accident, stroke, chronic lower respiratory diseases, diabetes, Alzheimer's, et cetera. Nowhere on that list will you see loss of skeletal muscle or sarcopenia, as well as obesity. You don't even see that on the list. Skeletal muscle is directly related for all of those that I listed, if not the root cause.
So in some ways, just like Alzheimer's disease is a loss of neurons in certain parts of the brain, the substantia nigra, the dopaminergic neurons in the brain, would you characterize a lot of the chronic disease we have as a loss of muscle? And no one is really thinking about it this way. Like, we're losing critical things for the body, just like neurons are critical. A brain, we're losing muscle with sarcopenia here.
I would say that when we think about what are the things that actually kill us from a metabolic perspective, the root cause is skeletal muscle. And again, there's many mechanisms, whether it's, is it an insulin resistance? Is it ceramides? Is it a mitochondrial dysfunction? Is it a receptor issue? I mean, there could be a million different, you just Google, you know, causes of, pathology in skeletal muscle. You'll find a million, right? I don't know if anyone has decided on what the overarching factor is. But one thing is for sure, it is the one tissue that you can do something about. An exercised, well-trained skeletal muscle is healthy skeletal muscle.
So what do you think is causing the muscle loss? Like all the, you know, like sometimes the research landscape is frustrating for me because randomized controlled trials are super valuable. And sometimes if we don't have them, we have to use our intuition and think as humans. What's your suspicion as a physician, as a clinician, of what is going on with sarcopenia, this loss of this critical endocrine immunologic organ in the body? Why are we losing this? Why is my mom losing this? Why is my dad losing this? Just like the loss of neurons in the brain with Alzheimer's or dementias or neurodegenerative diseases, we essentially have musculoskeletal, we have muscular degenerative diseases as humans. Like, what do you think is going on? It's just a, what do you believe, what do you suspect as a physician is going on?
When I think about the hallmarks of aging, I think about protein turnover and proteostasis. And I believe that we are not able to keep up with the lifestyle. So humans are largely domesticated. This is a Western disease. This is not a disease that I believe has to happen, by the way. What I believe is happening is twofold. Our nutrition as we age is totally off base. It starts young, habits start young. We do not keep up with our changing physiology. And the balance between exercise and movement and nutrition changes. When we're younger, again, you could have done bicep curls in college and you probably were eating some Twinkies or something else and you were still able to put on muscle. Let's be frank. Okay. You were able to do all those things, whether you got eczema or psoriasis or whatever it is, you were able to do a lot of things that potentially wouldn't be healthy and you still probably looked great. As individuals age, that wave of youth closes. The capacity to leverage the youthful hormones, to leverage the body's plasticity while the window never completely closes until it's over, the ability to push hard enough to stimulate that tissue becomes more challenging. I believe that we are under-eating dietary protein. I believe that we are eating too low of a nutrient-dense diet. From an iron standpoint, from a B12 standpoint, from all these nutrients that we need. And we are not pushing our bodies hard enough. We are deeply domesticated. And then you throw in some low-level inflammation. You throw in some shitty food. You throw in lack of sleep, which also suppresses. I was talking to one of the researchers out of Galveston, and one night of sleep restriction might affect muscle protein synthesis by 18%. One night. Crazy. And that's what I think is happening. And the other thing is the nutrition landscape is never empirical. It's never an empirical conversation. It is a conversation that is wrapped with politics, that's wrapped with morality, wrapped with things all related to other aspects than actually the data.
Yeah, well said. So the food, the nutrition landscape is very political, which is why Impossible Burger and Beyond Burger exist. Those are political statements rather than nutritional statements. Clearly, I mean, that's a political statement based on faulty science regarding the climate. And I don't want to go down that rabbit hole now, but let's talk about protein because I think this is fascinating. And I've learned a lot about this from talking to you and your work and your mentor, Don Lehman's work. Like, I did a reel on Instagram inspired by the work you guys have done about leucine. And I think I was looking at one of Don Lehman's papers, and you studied with him.
I worked on those early papers, but if you're an undergraduate, you don't get your name on the paper.
Yeah, it was probably a paper.
They don't believe that. It was probably
a paper you worked on looking at the amount of leucine, which is a branched chain amino acid required for optimal muscle protein synthesis. And the calculation I came up with was, you know, something like 8 ounces of red meat would give me easily the optimal amount of bioavailable leucine for my frame of 160 pounds, 170 pound human, you know? And to get an equivalent amount of leucine, assuming that that leucine is equivalent bioavailability in plant foods, I would have had to eat pounds of lentils. Pounds. Let's just talk about, like, I mean, look, I don't have to mince words on this podcast. Like, plant protein is garbage. But correct me if you feel differently. Like, you can get it, but you're going to have to eat way more, and it's not going to have the same nutrients associated with it. Like, how much protein does somebody need? Let's talk about optimal muscle protein synthesis. Let's talk about leucine. And then let's talk about other amino acids, specifically like maybe threonine in the gut.
I would love to. We talk about protein as if it's just one thing.
Yeah.
That it's a generic macronutrient. There's proteins, fats, and carbohydrates. But dietary protein is made up of 20 different amino acids, 9 of which are essential. The 9 essentials must be eaten. Your body cannot make them. And they all have diverse biological roles. And they're not interchangeable. To your point about plant and animal protein, you could look at the back of a label and a hemp burger or something could say it has 10 grams of dietary protein, but the leucine content is different. The methionine content is different. The tryptophan content, all of these, it's not going to be the same ratio. And to put it simply, the next phase of nutrition research is going to recognize these limiting amino acids, and the main ones are methionine, leucine, and lysine, and limiting to various degrees. That is going to be the next focal point. When you look at the back of a food label, and I'll get to it, but I think it's important to frame this conversation because I appreciate how well-rounded your listeners are. I mean, they're deep into the science. That when you think about these individual amino acids, each of these individual amino acids are nutrients. But when you look at the back of a food label, it only lists 14, right? 14 vitamins and minerals. What about threonine, which is important for mucin production? Threonine, 75% of threonine will be utilized to make mucin production, which is responsible for the health of the lining of the gastrointestinal tract. Methionine, a lot of the vegan vegetarian diets are methionine deficient, mostly vegetarian or vegan diets. And that's important for one carbon metabolism. That's important. It's a precursor for cysteine and subsequent glutathione production, which is the master antioxidant. And what about taurine? There's some great papers that have just come out about taurine and aging. Taurine is also important for the eyes. Lysine for carnitine synthesis, fatty acid oxidation. The list goes on and on and on. It becomes cumbersome to begin to think about each of these individual amino acids. The way to avoid that, and you and I have talked before about PDCAS and DIAS, all of that is essentially somewhat useless because it is not translatable. You are not going to look at the back of a label and go and try to find the PDCAS or DIAS score. That is a bit archaic and it's going to change. What we can count on is when we hit the needs of skeletal muscle, the protein needs for skeletal muscle, then everything else falls into place. That would be 0.7 to 1 gram per pound ideal body weight. The current recommendation is 0.37 grams per pound. I'm 115 pounds. For me, that would be 45 grams of protein. That is the minimum to prevent deficiencies. That has not changed since 1968. And again, based on nitrogen balance studies, to my knowledge, there are no health outcomes for nitrogen balance, which, by the way, nitrogen balance was adopted from agriculture to how do we raise cattle with the lowest amount of protein needed and the highest amount of carbohydrates to do it cheaply and to not stunt growth.
It's crazy.
Now, I want to mention something else. As we age, why do we need more protein? Because we do have to counterbalance, whether it's anabolic resistance. Again, skeletal muscle is a nutrient sensing organ. It essentially senses the quality of the diet, particularly sensitive to amino acids. Of those amino acids, it's exquisitely sensitive to leucine. That efficiency can go down. I say can because I actually am in line with you in terms of we don't have a ton of data on highly exercised older adults. You still see data that talks about people being healthy and sedentary in the same sentence in the literature. There's no such thing as a healthy sedentary person. Skeletal muscle as a nutrient sensing organ, there is the potential for that nutrient, the efficiency to go down. The way in which you counterbalance that is by having a robust amount of high quality protein. I also want to mention that the RDA, which is the minimum to prevent deficiencies, was also based on high quality protein.
Mm-hmm.
Our plant-based friends, that means the average adult intake of protein is around 68 grams for women and maybe 90 grams for men. And that is not all from high quality proteins. There was also a proof of concept. I think it was a French group that showed that the lower the protein intake was across the board, the higher the amount needed to come from animal-based sources.
There's just so many benefits to eating animal protein. You mentioned taurine. I did a whole podcast where I talked about the unique nutrients found in animal foods, especially for longevity. Taurine has been studied across multiple species for longevity, and it's not found in plant foods at all. Now, the human body can make it, but it doesn't make enough. And there's clear benefits to supplementation. Well, it only occurs in meat. So how can meat not be beneficial for longevity in every sense of the word? And if you look at the longevity, quote, experts in the space or people who are high profile in the longevity space who are doing vegan diets, which to me is an oxymoron. I was going to say oxymoronic, but that sounds like I'm being derogatory, which I probably am being derogatory, but I don't even know if oxymoronic is a word. What a coincidence. They're supplementing with creatine. They're supplementing with taurine. They're supplementing with things that occur only in animal foods that are clearly beneficial. And to me, this is just kind of a fool's errand. It's an intentional fool's errand, and it's good that they're experimenting. I just think that it doesn't make sense the way they're doing it. So
we have a whole population to feed.
Yeah. Well, this is the problem. You've talked about this.
We have a whole population to feed. When individuals are talking about longevity in that way, who does it ultimately affect? There are vulnerable populations that don't even get enough iron. I was just looking at the statistics this morning. There was a recent conference in the Netherlands, which Don went to, and they were talking about that a healthy diet was, quote, out of reach for almost 3.1 billion people, and that there are 122 million people pushed into hunger since 2019. 1.6 billion women of reproductive age and young children have micronutrient deficiencies worldwide. Okay. 1 in 2 preschool age children and 2 to 3 women of reproductive age worldwide have some kind of deficiency. One of the major deficiencies is iron and calcium. This idea that we should reduce our animal products for any number of reasons is grossly irresponsible. And the effect that it will have on vulnerable populations is dangerous. And when I say vulnerable populations, this idea of a meatless Monday, not only does it have almost no impact at all, because of course, you know, even in the US, agricultural combined is about 9% versus industry, which is 80-some percent industry, electricity, and transportation. If you really care about the environment, then you're looking there. You're not looking at the smokescreen of affecting our children. And once you affect a child, they can't necessarily recover in that way during their growth. their growth phase. And then the other aspect of that is I still see patients. I still see patients twice a week. And one of the most difficult things to change is to change a person's mindset and habits. If we ingrain upon the younger population, the younger generation, that they should go meatless because it's going to make them morally better and et cetera, you can just put it in however you want to, the invisible implications above and beyond nutritional create challenges because then they go on to have families.
It's a horrible cascade. I have a friend here in Costa Rica. He's an incredible surfer. He's 14 years old. So he's homeschooled. He might turn 15 soon. He surfs at least 10 times better than me. And he texted me the other day and he said, look at this project that I got. I think he may be on some homeschool curriculum. And it was write two paragraphs about why reducing animal protein is good for health and the environment. And it just made me so nauseous to think about this propaganda that is happening. And it's why we do the work we do, because you and I both believe in tandem that this narrative is wrong and that it's harmful for humans. And that at the level of climate and at the level of nutrition, less meat is just going to create weaker, more decrepit humans. And starting with kids and really, frankly, brainwashing children in a way that mirrors the way that we're brainwashing children in many ways today, to say less animal protein is better is just, it's criminal. And it makes me really frustrated. And I agree with you. Meatless Mondays is, in my opinion, akin to some sort of pseudo child abuse. Let's take kids who only get school lunches and may not have access to any other
quality food
and or a quality in quotations. And we're going to take away the most nutrient dense part of their food. We're going to take away the actual.
And in nursing homes and in the military. It doesn't stop anyone that gets government funding. You know, for this book, Forever Strong, that I wrote, I did some of the research of the history, and it's fascinating. I'm sure you've looked at this. Have you looked at the commodities budget versus the processed food budgets?
No, tell me.
Okay. When I was doing research for this book, I thought it was very important to look at the past. In order to understand the future, there's a component of the future that we repeat in the present moment. I went back and I looked at the past history. And when the Great Depression happened, and on the heels of World War II, they drafted the first 1 million soldiers. 38% of them were unfit for war. That's 380,000 people were unfit for war. They described these individuals with poor eyesight. They described them as having flabby muscles. They described them as weak. They described them as, you know, having poor dentition, etc. When the U.S. was at risk for losing their country to Hitler, they determined that nutrition was critical and there had to be an intervention. They called for this 3-day committee. They started to push out education. And they, I'll never forget this. There's one pamphlet that they pushed out, and you guys can Google it. And it showed one pamphlet that said, here's how to help Uncle Sam. Because what they recognized was they needed strong, so they talked a lot about vitality and strength and muscle health in the 40s. What they did is they pushed out these pamphlets and they said, if you want to help Uncle Sam, here's how to do it. You'll eat high quality protein, a big high quality protein lunch with liver and eggs and beef and chicken and dairy. You will also eat fruits and vegetables. You will also salt your food. You will like have salts. If you want to help Hitler, it showed a very skinny, right? And it really promoted liver for eyesight. So they recognized all these things. It was all about muscle health. On the other side, it said, if you wanted to help Hitler, it said, don't eat protein, eat white bread, processed foods. Essentially, a ultra kind of processed plant-based diet. And they recognized it at this time when their backs were up against the wall. They also would begin to encourage individuals. So they needed to get the soldiers stronger. The soldiers were eating about 250 grams of protein a day. They were rationed about
250 grams of protein.
And you can find this in some of the very old literature.
Wow.
something happened where food processing became more prevalent, obviously because they had to can and they had to package. And there was this tipping point where individuals were then encouraged to grow victory gardens and send all their high quality foods to the soldiers. And again, something happened, and whether it was money or Sylvester Graham or Kellogg, there began to be this narrative. And what this narrative did was individuals would begin to self-restrict proteins and high quality foods to send them over to the soldiers and eat more highly processed foods to be moral and to help our soldiers. Somewhere along the line, we really picked that back up. And what I'm seeing from my perspective is a reemergence of self-imposed rationing for morality. Now, I don't want to go down the rabbit hole, but this is, again, from looking at the history of it to today, it is the same process with a different narrative. The other aspect of this is a commodity for the listener is a whole food. A commodity would be beef, chicken. So if I say beef, you say what's for dinner. If I say pork, you say the other white meat. They're all one sentence taglines. These are all commodities, soy, corn, any whole food. We don't know the individual corn farmers, the individual dairy farmers, the individual beef farmers. I mean, the majority of us just see beef at the grocery store. We don't know who the individual farmers are. They collectively pool their resources together, all commodities, eggs, pool their resources collectively together. Their marketing budget is $750 million. All commodities, everything combined is $750 million. This is under the jurisdiction of the USDA. This also means that the USDA commodities can never say anything disparaging against other foods. Beef, what's for dinner, cannot say it is a better, more high quality, bioavailable protein than a fake burger. Mm. It cannot come to the defense if oat milk or oat juice comes out and says this is better for the planet and this has more calcium or whatever made up nonsense happens. Milk cannot say, no, we're a better, more bioavailable source of calcium. The marketing budget of a processed food is under different jurisdiction. So FTC, it's a different domain. One company, let's take PepsiCo, has a marketing budget of almost $2 billion. Now, I just told you that the commodities collectively have $750 million. $2 billion. Who controls the money controls the narrative. The commodities can't, and the commodities' hands are tied. You will never see them come out to defend themselves. They cannot.
And when you start to really uncover some of this, it's just so sinister. My friend Andrew Huberman told me once, he sent me this article, like 19 of the 20 people on the 2020 to 2025 USDA guidelines for the diet in the United States have ties to industry and pharmaceuticals. 95% of people.
We have 40 million people on statins. We don't talk about muscle health. But we have 40 million people on statins. People care about triglycerides. They care, you know, if you care about triglycerides, if you're worried about your fatty acids, if you're worried about your cholesterol, then you should have healthy skeletal muscle. Skeletal muscle burns fatty acids at rest. But don't do that. We're going to put 40 million people on statins.
Which are negative toward skeletal muscle, right?
Yes.
Because of coenzyme Q10 interrupting the mevalonate pathway. That's creating cholesterol, which also makes squalene and going like, yeah, it's crazy. So the cards are stacked against us. And unless we share information like this, our children will be indoctrinated and the people we know who are not so plugged in will be indoctrinated and think that it's okay to eat a plant-based burger because it's better for the environment. It's actually healthier for me. It has the same amount of protein as meat. And hey, they put this fake stuff in it called leg hemoglobin that makes it red and it kind of tastes like meat. Great. I'm doing all the good things. And
the metabolomics are totally different. It's not interchangeable. If you want to eat it, fine. and it probably has some kind of phytonutrients, which you and I think maybe vary on this perspective, but it's not replaceable.
There's not even, I mean, yeah, I mean, that, I don't even think there's many phytonutrients in a burger that's full of, we did some content about it the other day. I was comparing real ground beef to the way that ground beef is made from plant-based burgers. And the main ingredients in these plant-based burgers are soy protein isolate, seed oils, methyl cellulose, which is just sawdust. And some of them have coconut oil. So it's like, there's not even any phytonutrients left in soy protein isolate. So it's crazy. Well, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. Thank you for the work you do. I'll let you leave the listeners with some actionable recommendations and let them know where they can find more of your work and your book.
Yeah. So thank you so much for having me. My new book is called Forever Strong, and it's a whole different approach to longevity, and it focuses on muscle-centric medicine. And most importantly, it reframes the conversation. It gives you exactly what to eat, how to exercise, how to think. There's a whole mental framework on there, and it's very evidence-based. There are so many. I had to cut 200 pages out of this. You can find it on Amazon. You can find it on my website, Dr. Gabrielle Lyon, and it is a game changer. It's the first book of its kind written that focuses on skeletal muscle as the largest endocrine organ in the body. It is out now. You can also find out more about me on my podcast, The Dr. Gabrielle Lyon Show, which Paul will be coming on.
I better. Hopefully. I can't wait.
You better. We're number 4 in medicine. We're doing great.
Let's do it.
Let's see what else. And then I have a great newsletter and I'm on Instagram. You can find me there. But definitely, if you have questions about this new narrative, you should get this book, Forever Strong, and join our community.
Thank you so much for the work. I think that there is longevity is a buzzword now. And most of the conversations I see around longevity are missing a lot of the critical elements that you're talking about in your work. So thank you again. And I hope that we get to hang out in person and eat steaks very soon.
Thanks.